Hey guys, before we get into the podcast, I wanted to let you know that we're launching Barbell Medicine Plus so that we can expand on what we're doing with the podcast, the website, and beyond. Now, over the past 300 plus episodes, Dr. Baraki and I have tried our best to be one of your go-to resources for legit, evidence-based health and fitness information. But now, with your help, we want to do more. Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers will enjoy ad-free listening, and for nearly all of our episodes, receive access to an executive summary and an article, along with the transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baraki and I questions, which we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. We'll be publishing other exclusive content for Plus members as well, and we've already uploaded a lot of resources for our subscribers and will continue to expand this offering. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. Thank you in advance for your support. Let's get into the episode.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. On the other end of the line, we have the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, I'm doing all right. Just wrapped up some time at work. It is a new academic year. Got some fresh minds right out of medical school, getting started with their internship that I got to supervise for the first few days of their residency, which is always fun and sometimes entertaining.
So, oh, yeah. For those who are not in the medical field or who are like, you know, unaware of kind of how the academic calendar year works in medicine, like July 1 is effectively the start of every new medical calendar year in academics. So people who graduated medical school this past year are now starting their residency as an intern July 1. And those who are previously interns are now second years or third years or whatever. So July 1 is an exciting time for in medicine, not only because like July 4th is right around the corner and, you know, the emergency rooms tend to be overrun on that, those sort of things, but just because of the new crop. So exciting. I was, you know, it's funny. I started my intern year on vacation.
Oh, that's kind of lame.
We get like two week block, like of vacations, right? So you get two week blocks during intern year. And I started on vacation. So I didn't actually have any of that, like,
yeah,
you know, existential dread. And then I started on neurology, which was chill, you know, so whatever.
Yeah,
but I imagine starting on ICU.
That was me day one as in the sickest floor probably in the whole city that I was in at the time. That was kind of terrifying, but we got through it.
Okay, here's my hot take on like what would be worse, because when you say that you started on an ICU, you know, again, my heart starts to beat a little faster. I get a sympathetic nervous system response, just maybe it's a little PTSD, because you think it's going to be the hardest and maybe, quote, the worst. I actually think now in hindsight, it may be better in some ways. One, you're coming straight out of med school, which, you know, you're familiar at least with like all the terms and the processes. You're kind of tuned up on some level. But because you don't know anything about how, like, what really happens in the hospital, you have a higher level of responsibility, you have to learn so quickly during the ICU stuff. So at that point, I think it almost sets you up for a better intern year, even though those first few weeks, certainly the first few days, are going to be very intimidating and difficult.
Yeah, it's scary, but you're supervised, you know, more or less, depending on the place where you're working, but you end up being much less afraid after all that. I mean, I think going from that unit where my first, you know, couple patients that I still remember included like a case of disseminated XDR tuberculosis and, you know, bad cirrhotic, you know, GI bleeding and a lung transplant patient and all sorts of like really, really sick folks, going from that to a less acute type setting, a regular hospital floor, or definitely to like outpatient care, you're like, oh, wow, like none of this is scary anymore.
Yeah. So, yeah, I started on neurology and like memory clinic and stuff, which is, you know, different levels of acuity and like, you know, a lot of like active medicine and problem solving going on. And then I ended on ICU. So on the other hand, I got to ICU and I was like, okay, I feel like I have a really good lay of the land as far as how the hospital works and like how to get stuff done and like what sort of what's expected out of me, and like, you know, trying to operate up to my level of training, potentially above. So that's like a different experience. But I think in hindsight, if I maybe had the opportunity, instead of starting on vacation, just get like a 2-week block of ICU, like, well, hey, welcome to the show. That would have been, that would have been interesting. But that was a long time ago. And in any case, on this podcast episode, we're going to talk about delayed onset muscle soreness. So we could do a little deep dive into that. We're also got case files, so new mystery case, Quack Watch, backed by popular demand, and headlines. So we'll start with headlines. Recent headline. Did you see this? This came out maybe a few weeks ago. This was on CBS and ABC. They both had a very similar headline. A new study shows that 1 year of this kind of exercise yields results 4 years later. Did you see this?
I think so. Yes. Like they, it was basically like relating to intensity, and they showed, I think, that some higher intensity training had like a greater degree of persisting benefits years later. But I just saw kind of some of the headlines. I didn't delve into it in great detail. It seems like you did.
I mean, you know, we did. This was a study from the LISA cohort, LISA group, which is an acronym, stands for Lifestyle Factors on the Development of the Immune System and Allergies in East and West Germany. So obviously out of Germany. The original data set was like recruiting a bunch of newborns in the mid to late 90s, but they also included some older individuals in the community. And so this particular study comes from that later, that secondary recruitment, where they got 451 home-dwelling men and women aged 62 to 70 years old, and they were randomly placed into one of three groups. Group one got supervised, what they called heavy resistance training. These folks trained 3 times per week, doing 3 sets of 6 to 12 reps at 70 to 85% of their estimated one rep max for 9 different exercises. That's group one. Group two got home-based moderate intensity resistance training. Basically, they did circuit training with body weight and or resistance bands for 3 sets of 10 to 18 reps at approximately 50 to 60% of their estimated one rep max for, again, 9 exercises. And the third group was the control group. They basically did their habitual activity. And so what they did is they had them do this training for a year. They had measured a bunch of different things at zero, like before the intervention, then after the intervention at 1 year, and then they did subsequent follow-ups out to 4 years, just to see like, hey, we did this for a year, like what happens later? The main outcome we're going to focus on here is isometric leg strength, which they measured on a leg extension machine. Although interestingly, in this particular study, the brand name of the test, the testing apparatus was called Good Chair.
Yeah, which never heard of it.
I mean, I think it should be called Bad Chair. Like, what is there like a competitor in this space? There are a bunch of other outcomes they tested relating to like brain volume. They did some MRI stuff on that. They did MRIs of the thigh for muscle cross-sectional area of the vastus lateralis. That's one of the 4 quadriceps muscles on the outside of your leg. They also tested how much physical activity these people were doing as far as like walking around. They used some wearable technology, an accelerometer, DEXA for body fat and such. Okay, so for the results, they had 369 people that they got to follow up at year 4, which is actually pretty good out of 451. That's a pretty long time interval. So they lost 82 folks due to, quote, lack of motivation or severe illness. I would have been curious about the severe illnesses that popped up in this population. But the average age was 71. 61% of the subject group were women. At 1 year, the quadriceps strength and lean body mass all increased in response to this heavy resistance training, and to a lesser extent in response to the moderate home-based resistance training, which is kind of what you would expect. They were all better than the non-exercising control group. So at a year, the people lifting heavy weights in that supervised setting gained about 0.7 kilos of lean body mass, which for folks in their 7th decade, not bad, I guess, over a year. Whereas the people training at home with resistance bands had and bodyweight exercises increased their lean body mass by about 0.3 kilos, and there was no increase in the control group, which actually I thought was maybe one of the more interesting points, that after a year of no real formal training, people in this demographic didn't lose any muscle mass, which you would kind of expect otherwise. As far as leg strength goes, here's where things start to get weird, because I tried to look up like, what are standardized values for maybe like leg extension strength tested this way? Is there a minimal clinically important difference? right, in values. I could not find a consensus on that. But the heavy resistance training group went from 144 Newton meters to 165 Newton meters after their 1 year of resistance training on this isometric leg extension test. I don't know if that's good or bad. I know that the higher number seems better, but like, what do you think your isometric leg extension strength is? Is it like 700? Like,
Yeah, these are just numbers to us. I don't think that we have like, you know, we know, for example, in kilos, like what we might expect to move on a given lift, but Newton meters isn't very abstract unit for us to be thinking about. And yeah, there's also, you know, the reliability of these measurements in terms of what's the error bar around it, what's just like test variation, what's the skill component, things like that. So I agree. This is one of those things that that the directionality was up seems good, but we also don't know how meaningful that is.
Yeah. The moderate intensity group also went up from 147 to 155. So just broadly speaking, the heavy resistance training group went up by more, but both the groups that exercises went up, which is seems to be good and what you would expect. The control group stayed the same. Probably more interesting, I think, was the sit to stand performance test. So basically they gave these people 30 seconds to do sit to stand reps. I don't know like what the height of the chair was or what the, you know, I assume they weren't letting them use their arms, but these folks were, you know, doing 16 to 17 sit to stand reps in 30 seconds, which for this age group population, pretty good to starting point. So they were like pretty healthy to start. Yeah. And so this exercise improved the sit to stand group, sit to stand performance in the heavy resistance training group by about 3 reps, 2.5 reps on average, about the same in the moderate intensity group. And so I guess I'm more impressed that there was similar performance improvements overall. And even the control group went up by an average of, you know, 1.7 reps. And you're like, huh. That to me is more interesting than the leg extension strength in an isometric setting. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I care more about people's sit to stand performance than I do about an isometric leg extension strength, although I recognize the value of those kinds of isometric tests in this type of research that we've talked about before, when there's a different test than the task that was trained and there's less of a skill component and things like that. But in terms of how likely is this to impact your life, I can lean a little bit more on the sit to stand outcomes than I can on a isometric leg extension.
Yeah. Yep. So after 4 years, so basically they train these folks for a year and then it's unclear what happened over the next 3 years. They literally did not comment over the next 3 years of time as far as activity levels. So we don't really know. It'd be very difficult to imagine that they said, okay, now stop exercising. That seems unethical and unlikely. Perhaps they just removed the supervised component of it. And they were just like, yeah, do whatever you want. So in any case, the group who trained with quote heavy weights, they started at 144-ish Newton meters on this leg extension test. And at 1 year after all the training, they went to 165 Newton meters. And then 3 years later, the average strength that they measured was 151. So yeah, it seemed like it went up and then it came back down, but was still higher than normal. And that's what the headline is for. It's like, oh, look, they did 1 year of exercise and had this persistent effect, which again, I guess is interesting. I just don't know that like level of improvement, you know, maintenance of, in this case, what, 6 Newton meters, is that important, right? Yeah. Or is it even like bigger than the variance that you would expect within the test itself, and so on? And further, like what happened over the next 3 years? Were these people continuing to exercise? The accelerometry data that they had suggests that these people were all walking about 10,000 steps per day. And again, they started with like a really good sit to stand sort of performance, which they did not test for 4 years later, which I would have been more interested in seeing. So I don't know. The headline to me, if it gets people to like start exercising because it's like, look, I can do a little bit and get a lot out of it, that's fine. But I think where I come back to is the sort of cumulative exposure sort of thing that we keep coming back to with most, not only disease processes, but also maybe like health promoting behaviors. So for example, there's like a pack year smoking history, like where smoking kind of takes its toll, or like continuous exposure to high blood pressure or high levels of atherogenic cholesterol, lipoproteins, cholesterol carrying lipoproteins. Well, maybe there should be like exposure for strength. Like how many years have you been strong and how strong were you? Because you would predict that the longer, the greater amount of strength years somebody has, the more that is contributing to their health promotion. Would you be on board with that?
Totally. It's interesting. Not that we necessarily need to, you know, do this in practice, but thinking about what kind of metric could you use? Is it like rep years or set years, or like your, what is your, I don't know, 6 RM and then that strength times the number of years you maintain it and stuff like those are all, those would all have favorable correlations in this context. I think when you're looking at those outcomes, yeah, it's like that they got stronger with training, that it decayed a bit with detraining, and that the high intensity group maintained higher than baseline is a finding. That's cool. I think comparing it to people who didn't do much of anything and potentially had more of a trend towards just decay below the baseline, that's a more useful kind of thing. That, you know, if you train particularly with a reasonable amount of intensity, even if you are for whatever reason unable to maintain that style of training, you're likely to end up better off long term than somebody who never trained at all. That's a takeaway that you could make. Of course, we'd prefer that people just continue training. Maybe that they didn't, continue tracking exactly what these people did during that time makes it a little bit more of a generalizable study in terms of like not telling people to stop, but just like we gave you a taste of training and then we just kind of disappeared and then do whatever you want for the next few years. And maybe there's an effect of some of them still continue to train more than they would have otherwise. That's a useful outcome. The thing that's most notable though is what you're alluding to, taking a pretty healthy, reasonably robust cohort at the start who could already do that many sit to stand reps. That's not really the population that I'm terribly concerned about. And it kind of reminds me of some of the nutrition research that we talk about where there's not enough contrast in exposures of like high fat, low fat, or whatever the case is. You know, you need a big enough difference to really see a significant effect. And so I would prefer just to see people who were not walking 10,000 steps and able to do 18 sit to stands at the start, and then seeing what the effect of these interventions were. Because when I think about an older adult who can do 16 sit to stands in 30 seconds, that is almost none of the patients that I see in the hospital, for example, who
totally
and who can, you know, do, you know, I don't know, probably like anywhere from 0 to maybe 6 or something like that on a good day. So seeing this type of an intervention in a group with a bigger contrast would be nice to see. I can obviously hazard some guesses. It would probably be similarly in line with these kind of things. But maybe we'd see something like maybe they, because of the accumulated comorbid medical conditions that these people have, maybe they have a blunted response to training. Maybe they decay faster. Maybe they decay all the way back down to baseline without continued training. Maybe they're less likely to retain the benefits because of, you know, having chronic diseases and being generally way more sedentary than people who are habitually getting 10,000 steps a day, which is something that we know can better maintain anabolic sensitivity in people, you know? That would be my prediction for such a study. They would respond to training, but they would atrophy, you know, a lot faster, at least back to baseline, if not worse, if you took a sicker, you know, more frail population. That would be what I would expect.
Yeah. Yeah. Ultimately, I think there's some subgroup analysis that could be done here that would also be interesting. Like you're alluding to, well, you gave people a taste of lifting. How many people persisted on their own accord? That would give you like a number needed to treat kind of metric there. Like see, oh, maybe if we did this big public health initiative just to like subsidize 1 year of training in like vulnerable populations, we expect that a third of them are going to continue to like keep doing it. So maybe that's worthwhile. You know, you have the bean counters crunch some numbers. But we should state that, you know, older individuals do respond relatively well to training. We think that the relative response and strength is about the same as younger individuals. The way I conceptualize this is that the peak strength that somebody gets to is likely to be higher if you start earlier in life as a general sort of rule, because it get more years training, your strength years kind of goes up, your exposure to training goes up. But, you know, if the best time to start training was 10 years ago, the second best time is today. So like, let's get going. And I think ultimately you'd want people to initiate and then adhere to, you know, exercise at a relatively high volume, as much as they can tolerate, as much as they can do over a long period of time. That's kind of how I'd summarize this. Cool. All right. Interesting headline. Now we get to move on to, you know, I think the listener's favorite part of our potpourri type podcast like this, mystery cases. So yeah, oh boy, this right. So for people at home, again, if you haven't listened to the Barbell Medicine podcast before, we do these mystery cases at time. These are real cases published in the medical literature, real humans. And what we do is I walk through the case with Dr. Baraki, presenting him chunks of information at a time. And I ask him his thoughts periodically on what he thinks the potential diagnosis would be, get a view into his thought process. And ultimately, I think it's not only fun and entertaining, but also there's some pearls as far as, you know, the professionals that are listening to the podcast, whether they're health professionals or fitness professionals, you get some cool takeaways. So, Austin, again, people like when I predict whether or not you're going to get this. I think that you're going to get it, okay? But I don't think that you're going to get it until the end.
Okay.
So, which, yeah, sometimes that's not been the case. Like, literally, we've done cases where you're like, yeah, I really am worried about this one thing. And I'm like, how are you here already? All right, here we go. The case. 35-year-old, previously healthy man presents to the emergency room for abdominal, quote, cramps and leg pain on both sides. He says that this started this morning, a few hours ago, but yesterday he completed a marathon and he had no signs or symptoms before or during the marathon. He describes the abdominal pain as widespread and can't localize it to a single spot. He also has had a few episodes of nausea and vomiting today when he tries to consume anything. He denies any blood in the throw up, in the vomit. For the leg pain, he also says it's widespread and it feels like muscle soreness to him. He denies any trauma or injury and has no numbness, tingling, or range of motion loss. His review of systems, and that's just the way that we go through all the different systems in the body and ask for different signs and symptoms to kind of clue us in on our differential. Well, his review of systems is significant for dark urine, dizziness, and lightheadedness without loss of consciousness or any falls. He's had no fever, no chills, no blood in the stool, or diarrhea. So before we get into any exam, labs, or imaging findings, any thoughts on this presentation?
Yeah. So we have, as we have had in several recent cases, multiple different symptoms presenting all at once. We have abdominal pain, leg pain in both legs, nausea, vomiting, dark urine, dizziness, lightheadedness. So this is kind of a big constellation of symptoms. And so where I'm going to put my focus would be on the things that I must explain by the end of this case discussion. And some of the symptoms are going to be kind of consequences of that main priority diagnosis that we identify. So for example, I'm not super fixated on his symptoms of dizziness and lightheadedness right now. I'm not super fixated on the nausea. Those are all kind of vague, generalized, not terribly specific symptoms that are probably going to be explained by whatever is ultimately going on here. Contrast that with a scenario where somebody comes in and their absolute primary concern is, I'm having dizziness, I can't see straight, the room is spinning. That's going to be when I focus my concern on that particular symptom. So I'm kind of setting those aside at the moment. So really, it's this syndrome of abdominal pain, bilateral or both leg pain, and the dark urine. And so, you know, we've done a case of, well, several cases of rhabdomyolysis before, which is a relevant consideration in the post-exertional context that we're dealing with here. We've had exertional rhabdomyolysis that can just be due to exertion, or it can be, you know, precipitated in the context of underlying medical conditions. People can have underlying disorders relating to their muscles. They can be on medicines. They can be on other things that can itself then increase their risk of getting rhabdomyolysis. So that's going to be my first kind of priority concern when I see a patient like this is, as we've done before, assessing their physical exam, their pulses, their vital signs, and then assessing their kidney function and looking for evidence of rhabdomyolysis. But as we've done in other cases too, even though there's maybe an initial temptation to jump towards a very specific diagnosis, we kind of need to avoid that temptation and think in terms of a broader kind of picture of what else could be going on. And so abdominal pain is a super big kind of syndrome that we see all the time. And there's many different organs in the abdomen that can contribute to abdominal pain. All of the main visceral organs, they can get, you know, inflamed, infected, obstructed. There can be vascular issues, things like that. And so when I, that's something that I can't make a ton of progress on just yet until we get some vital signs exam and, you know, plus minus, we may end up imaging this patient's abdomen. And then bilateral leg pain has become a more familiar concern that we've dealt with several times here, that I tend to break down into the different compartments of the leg, the bones and joints, the muscles and soft tissues, the blood vessels, and the nervous components of the legs. And then once it's bilateral, then we're looking for either some kind of generalized process affecting all the muscles, for example, or something more proximal, meaning higher up. So something affecting the nerves at the level of the spine can go into both legs, something affecting the blood vessels, you know, in the abdomen and can then go down into both legs. Whereas like a primary bone or joint problem happening immediately and symmetrically is a lot less likely. So that's kind of my initial thought process here. My inclination is definitely going to want to examine this guy, see if he's on any kind of supplements, drugs, anything else that can alter his risk here. See if he's had a history of something like rhabdo before. Get some vitals, exam of the extremities, the abdomen, the pulses, and then get some basic labs and imaging to help to narrow things a bit further.
Cool. All right, so let's move on to the physical exam. On physical exam, the patient appears calm, comfortable, and in no apparent distress. The case report actually describes him as stoic. So there you go. When asked, he said he is not currently on any medications. He does not take dietary supplements. He also has no family history of sickle cell, as far as he knows. His vital signs were normal. Significant physical exam findings were a mild tenderness to palpation of the abdomen without any rebound tenderness or guarding. Bowel sounds were heard in all four quadrants. His lower extremity exam was unremarkable. No signs of trauma, full range of motion, normal strength in all the tested muscles. His neurological exam was also normal. He got some labs in the ED, but first he was given 2 liters of normal saline. He was given an anti-nausea medication, Phenergan in this case, and 2 milligrams morphine IV for pain control, which subsequently relieved his pain, and also his nausea was controlled with the Phenergan. His labs were significant for a creatine kinase of 5,225 and an elevated white count of 16.3, along with mildly elevated transaminases, the AST and ALT values from his liver. Electrolytes were normal. So before we go any further, there was no additional imaging done in the emergency room. Any thoughts based on this finding?
Yeah, I mean, this is a pretty common type of presentation. I'm actually surprised that his CK is not higher. That's not actually that terribly high of a creatine kinase level that would raise concern for like really severe rhabdo. Although, you know, maybe that suggests that this dude actually was like pretty well trained for his marathon.
That's what I was thinking. I was like, I tried to look up like what are the average CK values in a group of trained people doing marathons? Because now I'm thinking, I'm like, do you even do a marathon, bro?
Yeah, right. Yeah, my CK level would be markedly higher if I put myself through a marathon. And so, you know, that their management giving him some fluids and basic symptom control, that's like totally routine. And the AST and ALT elevations also expected in somebody who has a CK elevation. Those enzymes can come out of muscle cells as well. That is electrolytes, kidney function normal. That's all super reassuring. The elevated white blood cell count is just something that I'm noting. It's something that we can see in terms of a stress response or an inflammatory response, sometimes due to, for example, infections. It's not shocking to me that he has an elevated white count in the aftermath of a marathon and potential, you know, mild rhabdo. In my mind, 16 is maybe a little bit higher than I would expect for the degree of CK elevation. And if he's now a full day or so out from his day or two out from his marathon. So I'm just kind of noting that. I don't think, like, at this point, you know, you said you don't think you're going to get the diagnosis until the very end. I'm not really getting any threads to pull on that take me away from like a run-of-the-mill, you know, case of post-exertional, you know, DOMS to rhabdo kind of spectrum. If I had to hunt, you know, further for something, I'm going to need like something that doesn't fit my usual, what we call an illness script for, you know, post-exertional syndromes like DOMS and rhabdomyolysis, something that really sticks out, doesn't fit. Like if everything else improves and his white blood cell count keeps going up, or if he suddenly starts having fevers, or, you know, something else that doesn't fit what I expect for a usual trajectory of this, that would be a thread that I would start pulling on to like say, okay, this is definitely a scenario where I need to broaden my search and look beyond. But, you know, I don't feel the need to go wild with like over testing, searching for a really rare diagnosis just yet in the absence of whatever pivot you're about to give me here soon.
Well, so the physicians in the emergency department were kind of like, does this guy even need to be admitted? Like if this is, you know, exertional rhabdomyolysis, we're not terribly impressed just based on the CK and the presentation. Although interestingly, they didn't do like a urinalysis to be like, oh yeah, we got myoglobin in the urine. That's why it's red. Like we don't really know that. You suspect that's the cause. And no additional imaging was done. So they don't really, you know, have some reason to admit him. So they asked him, they said, hey, do you feel like you could go home and care for yourself? And the patient responded without hesitation that he fears for not being able to keep anything down and to feel more comfortable staying in for hydration and observation. So at that point, you're like, well, the patient thinks they're sick. I kind of don't know why they're here, but otherwise they appear sick. And so I'm not, you know, you do go through your mind of like, oh, is this malingering? Is there some sort of like secondary gate? Like what's going on here? But at the same time, you're like, well, if he thinks he's sick and I'm seeing some stuff that doesn't really fit like you said, an illness grip, like, well, all right, I'll observe this guy for a night, maybe. I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, that's a pretty common scenario. If that was, you know, what came up, I would just ask him what he means by, you know, what his main concern is. And if he's like, my nausea is so bad, or I'm like throwing up everything that I try to take down, then suddenly all this other stuff kind of falls away and I'm like less concerned about rhabdo. I would probably still just repeat his labs and see if they're trending in the direction I expect or not. But suddenly then I'm trying to solve, you know, a scenario of vomiting in the setting of abdominal pain. And then that is a very different type of, you know, problem that I'm going to try to crack. And that might involve other, you know, taking things in a very different direction, assessing for, you know, is there something going on in his gastrointestinal tract, in his abdomen? Is there some kind of an obstruction or something else going on that we need to get to the bottom of?
Right. So overnight, he was observed. He was continued on fluids. He received 1 milligram of morphine for abdominal pain, and he was made NPO overnight. His urine output was normal, and serial abdominal exams were unchanged from admission. His vital signs overnight were significant for a fever to 100.7. Also for the listeners at home, like 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit is usually our fever sort of threshold. So my least favorite thing to see in a medical chart is like mild fever, and then it's like 99.5. And I'm like, why did you call this fever? Anyway, that's for maybe another podcast. During morning rounds, the patient said he was feeling better. He had no nausea or vomiting. They did repeat labs. His CK trended down to 5,125, and his white blood cell count went down to 14.3. He was subsequently advanced to normal diet, and he ate a small breakfast, but his abdominal pain increased upon eating, and he threw it up. Repeat abdominal exam showed guarding and rebound tenderness localized to his lower quadrants, with his right being greater than left. So any thoughts here before we move on?
There's the pivot we were expecting. So he did end up having a little bit mild temperature. And I will say that, you know, it's actually possible for people to have a little bit of a fever, you know, in the setting of severe rhabdo. I would just not characterize this as severe rhabdo. And so I would be hesitant to chalk it up to that. So I'm just throwing the rhabdo part away now. That's whatever. That's done. The main concern, as we suspected, was that he's having this oral intolerance as vomiting, worsening abdominal pain, and a fever that is suggestive of inflammation. And when somebody has pain, particularly pain with eating, I think of that as, you know, the way I organize that is, what are all the organs that we need to be able to eat and digest food? It's almost like failing a stress test from an eating standpoint. So we need the eating tube, our esophagus and stomach and intestines and everything need to be wide open and moving stuff along okay. We also need our pancreas to be working okay. And we need our gallbladder and biliary system to be working okay. And then the blood flow to all of those organs needs to be sufficient. If any of those things is broken, then you can get worsening abdominal pain after you eat. So I'm curious about his kind of luminal GI tract. I'm curious about his pancreas. Could he have pancreatitis for some reason? Could he have cholecystitis for some reason? And then, you know, he's young and he was just able to complete a marathon. So my concern for, you know, mesenteric ischemia, inadequate blood flow, is definitely lower. It's not impossible for other like freaky reasons, but it's definitely lower. And then the last part you mentioned on his exam is he's having some lower abdominal discomfort, particularly on the right side, which there's certain tissues down in that area. There's your appendix, there's your terminal ileum, things like that can become painful. But ultimately, this is going to be something that is quite difficult to solve without imaging as our next step. He has probably some kind of an inflammatory focus in his abdomen, given the fever and the worsening abdominal pain. And the question is, what is the primary site of that inflammation? Needing to localize that is the most important step, because each of those would be managed very differently. If there was something in the GI tract itself, that would be different than pancreatitis, that would be different than cholecystitis, than appendicitis, than enteritis, colitis, than any of those kind of things. And it's not really possible to confidently differentiate those things, you know, enough to intervene on just a plain old physical exam in most cases.
Yep. Well, he did have an abdominal CT done that showed imaging consistent with acute appendicitis. General surgery was consulted. He went to the OR, got an appendectomy, had an unremarkable course, and was actually discharged the next day, which is interesting. It's like, wow, yeah. He had a meal, threw it up, and they're like, I guess he's NPO, so let's take him to the OR. So yeah, the diagnosis was acute appendicitis plus or minus exertional rhabdomyolysis. Unclear, because again, no urinalysis. The CK was meh, not terribly elevated. Like, I actually would expect it to be higher in a person who completed a marathon without rhabdo. And if they did have rhabdo, I expect it to be even higher. I'm thinking like 20,000s, 30,000s wouldn't be unreasonable. So the pearls here probably the biggest pearl is just to maintain a wide differential. And you kind of alluded to this earlier. And I keep coming back to maybe one of the first lessons I learned on diagnostic medicine is that your differential at the beginning has to be wide enough to include the correct diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so, getting hung up on a particular thing. Oh, it smells like rhabdo. It was treated as rhabdo. I'm going to call it rhabdo. That's one of the reasons why I didn't really like reading notes on a patient before I saw them, because I didn't want to get like lulled into thinking, oh, it is this thing. Now, obviously, if you had a great consultant or series of consultants that had weighed in before and there's this long history, that can be useful. But other times, if somebody's calling it one thing and you might get kind of, call it something that it really isn't. But the rhabdo with abdominal pain doesn't really fit post-marathon anyway. Nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain in general after like a lot of exertion, particularly with rhabdo, is certainly possible. But I wouldn't expect that to be like one of the focal signs with rhabdomyolysis, unless it was abdomyolysis from doing all like the glute ham sit-ups. And we've covered a case like that before. But as far as acute appendicitis, this is the most common abdominal surgical emergency in the world, with the lifetime risk of about 8.6% in males and 6.9% in females. It is common, as I alluded to, with greater than 1 million appendectomies performed in the United States alone every year. Most commonly presents in the second and third decade of life, with a slight preference for men over women. Early on in appendicitis, the autonomic nerves, so just nerves in the abdomen, can relay pain that is dull and widespread. That's this kind of guy. He just had diffuse, widespread abdominal pain. It wasn't just located in the right lower quadrant. Like if a guy came in, nausea, fever, vomiting, intolerance of dietary intake, and like right lower quadrant focal pain, you'd be like, yeah, it's probably appendicitis.
Right.
Like that would just be the diagnosis, but he presented differently, right? So you got to maintain this wide differential. Now, the most common treatment is surgery, but non-operative management has shown to produce similar outcomes for some. There's this whole like diagnostic algorithm, treatment algorithm that's available. So if someone has non-perforated appendix based on imaging, they're stable, they don't have sepsis, they're not pregnant, they're not immunosuppressed, no history of inflammatory bowel disease, you can discuss non-operative management with antibiotics. So people can get treated with antibiotics and like keep their appendix, which kind of affects this return to play. So return to play has not been studied with non-operative management, but it's presumably similar to surgical management. Post-op, there have been elite athletes that have played in professional American football games as soon as 1 week post-op. But the consensus of surgeons seems to be they recommend a 3 to 4 week period for the average person to return to sport, which is made up, but I don't really have a better recommendation outside of that. So
yeah, I agree.
Interesting case. Yeah, I mean, appendicitis is not particularly interesting, although I could think being kind of, taken down the exertional rhabdomyolysis path made it more interesting than it otherwise would be.
Yeah. I mean, there are obviously run-of-the-mill exertional rhabdo is something that, I see all the time. There are some much more interesting causes of rhabdo. And so, for example, I can give you a scenario where if this, instead of a guy who just ran a marathon, instead he did like one of those like trail run kind of things, or like the obstacle courses, like out in the forest where you're running through water and all sorts of other stuff. That would actually raise concern for an infection that could cause this, called leptospirosis, that can actually set off rhabdomyolysis, severe, muscle pains throughout the body, can cause fevers, can cause a lot of different things. Something that there are definitely a fair amount of case reports of from people doing those types of races that could present in this kind of a way that wouldn't have been an unusual type of manifestation, for example. So,
yeah, interesting. All right. Look, I'm warning you. This next segment of the Barbell Medicine podcast here with Dr. Austin Baracchi is our Quack Watch segment. I'm warning you, I think this is going to set you off. So just, maybe sip some tea, recite some mantras, meditate a little bit. Like it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this together.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. As a reminder, you can support the podcast and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, where you'll get ad-free episodes, exclusive access to summaries and articles for each podcast, along with an edited transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baracchi and I questions that we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. Head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus.
Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Now, Acorns is an investment platform, also have a bunch of educational tools on their website. I thought they had a pretty good product, so thought I would let them sponsor our podcast. They make it easy to automatically start saving and investing for the future. You don't actually need a lot of money.
or expertise to invest with Acorns. In fact, you can start with just your spare change. With Roundups, that's a program that they have to round up any purchase made from a linked account, debit or credit card to the next dollar, and that goes into your retirement or investment account. They also have Acorns Early, which is an investment account for kids, and they recommend an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. Head over to acorns.com/BBM or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/BBM. This podcast is brought to you by Rosetta Stone. If you've been listening to our podcast for a while, you know that I'd previously been trying to learn French using Babbel, a direct competitor to Rosetta Stone. And while I had a good experience with Babbel getting ready for this trip, Rosetta Stone offers 12 more languages than Babbel, including many Asian languages that Babbel does not. Additionally, Rosetta Stone is offering 50% off a lifetime membership, which is an incredible deal and basically forced me to let them sponsor this podcast. Now, Rosetta Stone is one of the most trusted language learning programs in the last 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. It's also available on desktop or as an app, so you can learn anywhere. And it uses an immersive experience to help you learn the language of your choice quickly, along with using the correct accent using its speech recognition technology. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Barbell Medicine listeners can get Rosetta Stone lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get 50% off unlimited access to 25 different language courses for life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today and get started. Sweater weather signals that fall is here, along with the holiday season right around the corner. But with the busy schedule, sometimes it's hard to eat the way you'd like to. That's where Factor comes in. Factor is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service and is much healthier than most takeout meals, which tend to be very high in calories due to both portion size and the ingredients that are used. You can skip the grocery store, skip the prep work, and the takeout trap, and let Factor do the work for you. Factor has options to help you fuel up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. They're ready in just 2 minutes, and they even have a protein plus option to make sure each meal has at least 30 grams of protein in it. This fall, get Factor and enjoy eating well without the hassle. Simply choose your meals and enjoy fresh, flavor-packed meals delivered to your door. Ready in just 2 minutes, no prep, no mess. Head to factormeals.com/BBM50 and use the code BBM50 to get 50% off. That's code BBM50 at factormeals.com/BBM50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off next month when your subscription is active. Austin, have you heard of the new Equinox Optimize program?
I have not.
You know what Equinox is, this commercial gym chain. I think they have 107 locations worldwide. It's like a fancier gym, but you know, they're widespread all over the world. You've heard of the gym chain?
I have heard of Equinox, yes.
Yes, so they're rolling out this Equinox Optimize membership plan. It's $40,000 a year, and it's supposed to, and I quote, designed to unlock the peaks of human potential. There's a partnership with Function Health, which is co-founded by Dr. Mark Hyman. So just already blood pressure starting to boil a little bit there. Austin has a deep sigh. Okay, yeah. So with this, you get twice per year functional blood tests. We'll come back to that. You also get a Aura Smart Ring, the gym membership, which by the way is like $4,000 a year on its own. You get 16 hours per month of coaching. It's 3 times per week personal training, which they average about $160 per session. You get twice per month sleep coaching. 30 minutes with the sleep coach. You also get twice per month nutrition coaching and a monthly massage.
Okay.
Now, here's where things are going to go sideways for you. All right. So this twice per year function blood tests, there's some good stuff in there. It's 100 items. That's how they advertise this. You get 100 different biomarkers checked each year. Now, there's some good stuff in there. The standard lipid panel, for example, apolipoprotein B, TSH, A1C, an iron, a ferritin, complete metabolic panel, a CBC, and STD testing. You could say, okay, that those seem reasonable for most adults. You don't need to get a TSH every time you get blood work. You don't need to get an iron checked for everybody.
Iron
obviously.
Is, yeah, serum iron is a pretty useless test. And I agree. I wouldn't broadly screen TSH in all comers, but you know, less objectionable than some of this other stuff that is coming up.
Yes, exactly. So like those things, again, you wouldn't be offended if somebody came to you and said, look, I got a standard lipid panel. I got a TSH. I got an ApoB. I got a CBC and CMP and STD testing. You'd be like,
okay, that seems like pretty reasonable. And a hemoglobin A1C, you're like, you didn't need that maybe in this particular adult, but carry on. But some bad stuff. So they have like a lipoprotein size and pattern, like multiple tests on that, which irrelevant, don't need that to guide management for anything. They're testing your selenium, your thyroid peroxidase level, some antibodies related to thyroid function. You got an autoimmune panel. They got an ANA in there, for
that
example.
Is an absolutely terrible idea. Oh my God.
testing for Lyme's disease, obviously testosterone, got to do that. DHEA, leptin, magnesium, homocysteine, vitamin D, zinc. I mean, you go all the way down the line to, you know, heavy metal detection. And it's like, what are you doing?
This is a nightmare.
I get it. Like if you're, a gym goer, super interested in like longevity or whatever, this sounds appealing to you. I get tested for all these things and I can, you know, head something off at the pass, right? There's like this belief that if you have just enough information, it'll change what you do, lifestyle, presumably, which I find, you know, okay, that's a hypothesis. But then when you go kind of look into the research on these particular lab tests and then what you would change about management outside of the general health promoting behaviors that we've, you know, long advised and recommended on a podcast, you're like, oh, so it's just the same stuff that you should be doing anyway.
Right.
And so then you'd have to argue that having this information makes it more likely that somebody's going to change their behavior than they otherwise would without these tests. And then after all of that, you have to say, okay, these tests aren't harmful in any way as far as like unnecessary procedures, unnecessary other diagnostics, unnecessary treatments. I don't know. What's your kind of take on all this?
Yeah, this is just it's throwing a lot of stuff at people that they're paying a lot of money for, so they think they're getting a lot of value out of, with absolutely no recognition of any of the downsides. A lot of folks just think that more data is always better. They'd rather know these things than not know them, which, you know, I see the consequences of this kind of stuff all the time. Most of those, you know, initial sets of labs, like checking a lipid panel or an ApoB or a ferritin or STD testing, like, cool, I'm down with those things for, you know, a lot of adults. But some of these other things are not only unhelpful, but potentially harmful. And they're also, many of them are just not great tests. And so two examples that I'll point out in particular here, one is the ANA, or anti-nuclear antibody test. And there is a pretty significant fraction of the population who have no problems, who are perfectly healthy, and who will have a detectable or a positive ANA level. On top of that, ANAs are reported as a titer, which is something that is even more confusing for people to try to interpret. It has to do with like the number of dilutions and things like that in the lab. So it could be like a 1 to 40 ANA, which is like pretty much meaningless, or it could be like 1 to 1280, which is typically more meaningful. But still, there's a fraction of the population who are completely healthy, who are never going to have any consequence of this, who are just walking around with it. And then you find it, and then people start looking it up, or the clinicians who are apparently guiding this service, who probably are not very good at lab interpretation.
Then you start learning, like, practitioner, by the way,
which, you know, the quality of training is highly heterogeneous, and the quality of experience and all that is just, I cannot broadly endorse this sort of thing. And then people start freaking out that they have lupus and they have an autoimmune disease, and then they join, you know, an online support group for their condition that they may or may not have, and get sucked down the rabbit hole of medicalizing, you know, everything about their life. Lyme disease testing, also a nightmare. And the idea, you said that there's like 160 of these gyms all over the country or something like that. Lyme disease is not equally distributed across all of this area, meaning that the prevalence of Lyme disease, the likelihood that you could have it, even if you presented with symptoms, is going to vary depending on these places. Meaning that if you're doing it at a Equinox that's in, I don't know, LA, where there's not a lot of Lyme disease, then you are going to get a false positive. Like if it's a positive test, you are overwhelmingly likely to have a false positive. And then sometimes those people get treated with antibiotics, and those antibiotics can have side effects and can kind of go from there. All of the hormone testing, again, is a mess in terms of interpreting the hormone tests in the absence of the person's like symptoms, syndrome, et cetera, where we don't just routinely look for what people's hormone levels are. And even then, they typically need to be drawn correctly, oftentimes at a particular time of day or in a particular context or together with something else that helps you interpret it better. And so I'm kind of ranting a little bit here, but I've talked before plenty about how complex lab interpretation is, and it's way more than just getting a number, looking up the number, comparing it to the reference range. That's as I feel like I've been saying this a lot lately. That's like that smooth brain doctoring, or clinicianing is just pulling a bunch of tests and comparing to the reference range, and then I don't know, giving somebody a supplement if it's off or something like that. It's nonsensical. So for anybody who's actually curious about this, who wants to know any more about how tests work, how we use them, how we should use them, how we shouldn't use them, I recommend going strongly to a website called testingwisely.com. Testing Wisely, phenomenal, very simple, straightforward, high quality educational resource on the use of diagnostic tests in clinical medicine. And going through that, if somebody's interested as a medical trainee of any kind, they will emerge with a excellent understanding of why this is nonsensical, but people will keep throwing money at this gym franchise that purports to be giving them excellent, high quality, detailed service.
To me, this seems like a cash grab, overall. If we came out with like a barbell medicine, like testing panel, it would be very, very small and short, but like at least actually evidence-based. You could make a case for a lipid panel. You could make a case for an apolipoprotein B, a one-time apolipoprotein little a. You could do STD testing. That would be recommended. And then, A1C in some individuals, and then blood pressure monitoring. Like, I think that would be like the list that you would endorse without, a lot of other caveats and certain demographic data. But man, this panel, good
absurd.
God.
Completely absurd.
Absolutely. All right. Through the Quack Watch segment, we're back here in the Barbell Medicine Podcast. We're going to do the main topic. We're going to talk about delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS. Austin, when's the last time you had DOMS?
Severe DOMS. It's been a while, but of late, with some of the changes in my training, trying out some newer movements, and definitely as I've been getting back into running a bit, like yesterday morning, I happened to run 5 miles. So I just felt a bit of some fatigues afterwards. Could have bordered on the edge of calling it some discomfort, some soreness. Not terribly bad, but it's been many years.
Yeah. I mean, I currently have some muscle soreness. I don't know if it's DOMS or just, soreness in general from poor sleeping habits, like which could potentially contribute here. But yeah, it's really interesting because DOMS has probably been around since human physical activity like became a thing that we were aware of as a species. But it was never described in the literature until 1902 with Dr. Huff. This guy was basically studying muscular fatigue by using an apparatus he devised at home. He would basically pull on a small ring with a finger that was attached to a pulley, which was attached to a weight, and he would keep pulling his finger like trigger until his muscles in his hand fatigued. And he was trying to figure out like what causes muscle fatigue, like how does this trend over time? And I guess he was doing this daily for almost a whole year, doing, thousands of reps per day. And then he took a 6-month break, came back to it, and he describes this muscular soreness that was beyond what he would previously have experienced. And he described it as, well, this happens when an untrained muscle makes a series of contractions against a strong spring. A soreness frequently results, which cannot be regarded as the phenomenon of pure fatigue. Because the interesting thing was, despite having the soreness, his performance, the amount of repetitions he was able to do, and the time of fatigue and the kind of curve of fatigue was unchanged. He was just more uncomfortable doing it. So that was 1902. And since then, you think, well, we've probably learned a ton of things that we can accurately characterize what causes DOMS, what prevents DOMS, what is the DOMS experience? It's not quite as clear. So first off, what is delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS? I think it can be defined as discomfort in the active muscles following physical exertion that increases intensity over the initial 24 hours, peaks somewhere between 24 to 72 hours post-workout, and then gradually subsides. Now, the severity of DOMS can range from mild to severe and is often associated with muscle stiffness and tenderness to the touch, but not always. If you just have a mild case of DOMS, like you're not going to really experience any tenderness to the touch, and you might not appreciate any increase in muscle stiffness. It's most commonly experienced after exposure to either new exercises and or higher volume workouts that involve eccentric muscle contractions. Now, eccentric muscle contractions are those where the muscle produces force while it is lengthening, such as the downwards phase of the squat or the bench press. This is thought to, like mechanistically, it's thought that during an eccentric contraction, less muscle mass is used to create force compared to a concentric contraction, which is muscular force production when the muscle is actively shortening. And because of the less muscle mass being used during an eccentric contraction, the active muscle fibers are under more tension per unit area, and this causes mechanical disruption of the muscle and connective tissue. So already we have this kind of idea, oh, it's muscular damage or it's connective tissue damage. But it's thought that might be one of the mechanisms here. Now, whether or not DOMS is a muscle injury is an area of, I'll call it active research. I don't actually know that there's a ton of research being done, maybe more just controversy and like nomenclature or pedantic differences here. Most international muscle injury classification systems do classify DOMS as an injury. So for example, the British Athletics Consensus states that DOMS is grade 0B, with grade 0 meaning that there's no MRI evidence of like muscular damage. And then B, designating that it occurs at the junction of the muscle and the tendon. The Munich consensus statement classified DOMS as grade 1B, where grade 1 refers to a functional, not structural, muscle disorder, and the B designation differentiates DOMS from plain old muscle fatigue. And this is actually important because after you exert yourself, you'll have some level of muscular fatigue, and differentiating the fatigue decreases in like performance. So whether that's strength or whether it's reduced repetition, something like that, differentiating that from actual DOMS related sort of decreases in performance is kind of tricky. Like, how would you do that, right? They're almost inseparable on some level, because if you do a workout that causes DOMS, you're also causing muscular fatigue, right? So in general, after a workout, the muscular force production generally returns to baseline within days. Whereas DOMS, on the other hand, is not present during a workout or immediately after, but gradually develops in the days following a workout and is not necessarily associated with the decreased force production. So effectively, fatigue is dissipated by the time DOMS peaks. So they're not really, doesn't seem that they're necessarily related. So Austin, this is a question for you. At what point do you start worrying about another cause of muscle pain besides DOMS in an active person?
Yeah, I would characterize it as just another cause of pain in general besides DOMS in an active person. And that kind of, this kind of ties into something that came up in our case earlier, right? We talked about what is the usual kind of expected trajectory of a case of rhabdomyolysis, for example. And if everything is following that expected trajectory, then I'm like probably in most situations okay with that as my diagnosis. But if there are elements of the patient's experience that don't fit that, like compared to that usual trajectory that you commented on, you have a big bout of exertion, maybe something clearly provoking novel, or I decided to do a bunch of GHD sit-ups and now my abs are sore and it peaked at 48, 72 hours and, you know, starting to get slowly better from there. If it deviates from that kind of expected trajectory, then I'd worry about something else. I also just take it a bit more seriously if the syndrome is, in a more concerning area, like if the person says this discomfort that I'm having is in my chest or in my back or my abdomen, then I'm going to just delve into those a little bit further. I'm going to want to see like a clear, like, oh, they did a clear chest, back, abdominal exertional workout that would fully explain this. And it's not associated with other symptoms like, oh, I'm also having shortness of breath, or I'm also having vomiting or something that would localize me a bit deeper in those cavities than just to the superficial muscles. And then in the extremities, the thing that I'd want to differentiate is kind of the characterization of what provokes it, what makes it better, worse. If, for example, one scenario that I could think of is like if somebody's having, you know, pain in their legs and I find out that it gets worse when they exert themselves and better when they rest, I might be worried more about some vascular problem like claudication instead of just chalking it up to like, oh, you're using your muscles, they're a bit sore, stiff. So that would be an example of something that doesn't fit the usual story for delayed onset muscle soreness that would take me in a different direction.
Yeah, and in fact, the exact opposite of what you'd expect with DOMS, because exercise, like with DOMS, is like one of the best ways to reduce the pain. It feels like exercise-induced analgesia is like the preferred way to reduce DOMS-related symptoms while you're doing it. And so if it actually gets worse with activity, you're like, doesn't sound DOMS-y to me. Okay, well, let's move on to what causes delayed onset muscle soreness. And we should be upfront that there's no real consensus on what causes DOMS. There's been a number of theories that have emerged related to muscle damage, inflammation, temperature of the muscle, neural mechanisms, and more. So let's briefly review some of these potential mechanisms. We'll start off with muscle damage. Now, again, the Munich consensus that defines DOMS as a non-structural muscle injury, so just a functional muscle injury, there is some evidence that DOMS can be correlated with small ruptures to the muscle fibers near the Z disc. Now, this is an area of the actual functional unit of the muscle, the sarcomere, that anchors one end of the thin muscle fiber known as actin. Myosin's in the middle, that's the thick fiber. And so anyway, there's some evidence of what's called Z disc streaming that you can get if you take a really high resolution imaging techniques, and you can see this. And sometimes you can correlate that to DOMS. There's also been some research that shows connective tissue elements surrounding the muscle fibers that can also be affected. Both of these changes in tissue are observed after exercise with an eccentric component. Now, ironically, stretching is often recommended to combat DOMS, but if performed, this would also theoretically affect the Z-band integrity. So you're like just doing more DOMS-inducing stuff. And in some instances where stretching has been studied, people get more muscle pain with stretching, presumably by this mechanism if we buy into it. And also, people can have like Z disc streaming and this, like, we'll call it ultra structural muscle changes without pain. So this happens in folks who don't have DOMS too. So it can't be perfectly explanatory for the DOMS phenomenon. We think also another like sort of element that might lead us down the muscle damage sort of pathway is that in mild cases of DOMS, usually it's the distal aspect of the muscle, so the thing further away from where the muscle starts. And it's thought because at this point, that's where the angles of the muscle fibers, the pennation angle is what it's called, are more severe. And so if you contrast that to the line of pull, like these would be the muscle fibers that have the most maybe shearing or sort of stress placed on them, given the angle. There's some element to that that's thought to be maybe contributory. And in any case, there's various markers of both muscle and connective tissue breakdown that can be observed in the blood and urine after a workout. So we think about creatine kinase that can be released from muscle fibers. Also things like hydroxyproline, hydroxylysine can be found in the urine. These are elements of connective tissue. But, and importantly, these findings do not reliably correlate with the severity of DOMS or even subsequent strength performance. So people will say, oh, my CK was 6,000, you know, what do you predict my performance to be in this workout or physical task? And you're like, I don't know, dude. And they're like, well, do you think I'll be sore? And you're like, I don't know, dude. That's the best as you can do. And additionally, there are discrepancies between these markers when they peak and this experience of DOMS, suggesting that at best, muscle damage is a partial explanation. As a final kind of nail in the coffin of muscle damage being the only sort of cause of DOMS or the main mechanism, force production potential returns in many contexts before DOMS peaks and while DOMS is actively going on at its peak, meaning that people, particularly in dynamic tasks that involve both eccentric and concentric contractions, DOMS doesn't necessarily reduce their strength performance. And so if you're thinking, you're like, well, DOMS is muscle damage, and if you have less functional muscle available to produce force, your performance should decrease. And even as back as far as 1902, Dr. Huff kind of proved this to be not true necessarily. So Austin, what would you say to somebody who wanted to measure, you know, these lab, you know, to track these lab measurements of muscle or connective tissue damage and its correlation to DOMS? What would you say to that?
I would say, as usual, lab interpretation is messy and complicated. I think that, you know, theoretically, there could be some utility for these things, perhaps to compare and contrast the kind of quote unquote muscle damaging effects of a given bout of exercise within a person. I think the problem, the bigger problem might, although even that is likely to vary, but the bigger problem would be if you try to compare them across people. And so, for example, there are measurements like creatine kinase, CK, aldolase, LDH, these are AST. These are all markers that can increase in the setting of kind of muscle damage, although also in other medical contexts as well. They're not perfectly specific here. But the issue is that you're measuring an absolute concentration of this thing in the blood. And the reason why you cannot and should not compare them across people is because people have differing amounts of muscle mass overall and differing amounts of muscle damage that is kind of going to get, you know, masked by that. In other words, the differences in muscle mass between people is going to be so great that you can, and their response to the training bout is going to be so great. So I've had, for example, last month. Yeah, I had a young guy admitted to the hospital for rhabdo who had just done MRF. And again, I live in a desert, so didn't have a great time with that. And his CK peaked at like 150,000. Which is among the highest I've ever seen. When I walked in and saw him, he looked great. He didn't feel particularly bad. He just sat in the hospital for like a week getting fluids to make sure he didn't go into kidney failure, but he was not miserable. He was not even in, you know, any significant amount of pain. We didn't have to give him any NSAIDs or Tylenol or anything else to manage that. Whereas I can think of another case of a woman who I had who had rhabdomyolysis, not necessarily from exertion, but from an autoimmune condition that was attacking her muscles. And her CK peaked at only like 9, 10, 11,000, somewhere in that range. And she was pretty debilitated by it. And so if I had just purely looked at the CK measurement, I would say, well, this guy must be crippled because he had 150,000, whereas he felt fine and, like, you know, waltzed out of the hospital. Whereas this other woman who had rhabdo, admittedly from another reason, but still muscle damage was the reason for her CK elevation to only 9,000, that wouldn't normally get me to blink. But because the, you know, her trajectory was not what I expected, we ended up chasing it further, and it was due to a condition called polymyositis. But I would say, oh, 9,000, that's not terribly bad. Whereas she was like unable to lift her arms up over her head. She had relatively little muscle to start with, and what she had was inflamed and damaged. So these markers can't really be compared across people. I would be curious, I'm sure this data exists, of like habituation to exercise as people get less and less, or more accustomed to exercise, and therefore get less damage from a given exercise bout, if you tend to have less of a CK, LDH, aldolase type bump. I don't know why I would care to measure such a thing, but it would be, you know, from a research standpoint, a probably more valid within people than it is across people.
Yeah, there's data that definitely shows that. Trained populations tend to have lower CK values after the same exercise sort of task. So habituation definitely occurs. Interestingly, though, compared to untrained individuals, the return of strength performance tracks on the exact same timeline. Again, you have to separate fatigue from the exercise bout from DOMS and potentially muscle damage as measured by CK. So again, at best, I think muscle damage is likely to be contributory on some level. Damage, I don't love that term, but whatever it's commonly understood. And it's probably a partial explanation of the DOMS experience. Another common mechanism that's said to cause DOMS is inflammation. Now, this probably started with the lactic acid theory, where lactic acid produced by muscles working in an anaerobic environment, like during resistance training or high intensity sort of conditioning efforts, with lactic acid was causal, like, oh, your muscles are burning and hurt later because of the lactic acid causing damage to the muscles, or lactic acid itself being like caustic, something like that. Again, it was thought that lactate is often called lactic acid. Well, these levels went up during anaerobic exercise, like I said, and it either caused damage to the muscle fiber itself and or stimulated specific nerves in the muscle that transmit signals that are often associated with pain. These are like group 3 and group 4 afferent nerve fibers for all our neuro nerds out there.
Nociceptors.
Nociceptors and such. However, this theory has been disproven a number of times from multiple different angles. So one, lactate levels return to baseline in minutes after exercise that has been completed, and thus do not correlate with the timeline of DOMS. Also, concentric-only exercise generates even more lactate than eccentric-only exercise, but does not produce DOMS. So, like, already, just off the bat, you're like, well, probably not lactate, or again, as some people incorrectly call it, lactic acid. Interestingly, though, lactate levels are sky high in individuals with sepsis, many individuals with sepsis. But do these patients have DOMS, Austin?
Short answer, no. No, they don't. No, they don't.
Like, that's not one of your sepsis criteria? For
No, I mean, lactate is a very acute kind of marker of a lot of things. The physiology of lactate is super interesting, and I'll spare the audience that physiology lecture here today. But I mean, it's been looked at where, for example, like elite, like Olympic level rowers, for example, will row like a super hard set on their rower, immediately hop off and get their lactate measured, and it's like 28 or something, which is like insanely high. And the only patient I've ever seen who had a lactate that high from a different reason, it was from anaphylaxis, and they died really, really hard. And so, you know, I get worried if I see any patient whose lactate is definitely cracking, you know, well into the you know, well above 2, 3, 4, 5, definitely the higher it gets from there, I'm already getting more and more concerned from a medical standpoint. But as you said, if the insult is addressed, even if it is an infection and we treat it, that lactate should clear pretty quickly. In the same way, after, you know, those rowers hopped off of the rowing machine, their lactate was super high immediately, but their physiology would be such that it would clear it very quickly, especially when you're trained. And so it doesn't even make a ton of sense that mechanism, you know, it's cleared literally within the order of minutes afterwards, compared with DOMS like peaking at 48 to 72 hours later. It's like, could they just have some, could they both be resulting from the same thing? Yes, but is one causing the other? I think a lot less likely.
Yeah, I agree. So this theory, after lactic acid, that sort of theory was kind of moved to the side. It kind of morphed into exercise-induced inflammation leading to DOMS by signaling various immune system cells and chemical mediators and so on that ultimately generated pain, swelling, and discomfort. This to me seems more plausible than the lactate theory, but there's still uncertainty here. So for example, it's not clear whether or not the immune response that have been documented after training are generated by the muscle or the connective tissue. So we don't really know necessarily where it's coming from. We also don't know if they're related to DOMS per se, or if they're just part of the muscle's adaptation process in response to exercise. So like, we don't know that it's causing DOMS, or if it's like, oh, this is how you get your gains from exercise. And finally, a number of these studies use muscle biopsies to investigate inflammatory responses and immune function after a workout, but few actually use a control group to rule out the effect of the biopsy itself, which would also cause inflammation in these inflammatory cells and mediators at the site of the tissue biopsy. So it's really hard to say. There's a kind of related theory. It's called the tissue fluid theory, where muscle swelling would actually like either compress certain nerves or otherwise lead to sort of discomfort that's associated with DOMS. But this hasn't been reliably shown across studies investigating DOMS, making it maybe one of the related mechanisms, but still mostly speculative. Few other mechanisms that have been investigated. One is temperature. I thought this was really fascinating. The temperature theory of DOMS suggests that muscle contraction produces heat and leads to an increase in temperature within the muscle itself, which stimulates nerves that convey signals that often are associated with conveying pain signals to the brain. So nociceptors, again, these group 3 and group 4 afferents. In support of this, the risk of exertional rhabdomyolysis and DOMS severity are generally higher in warm environments. However, there's less evidence supporting this theory otherwise, just kind of like one of those things that people have studied. There are people that I have studied, they use like it looks like a radar gun, but they're just measuring temperature, surface temperature of the skin during active muscular contraction. They're like, maybe it's temperature, man. I don't know. I mean, your immune system works better when it's hot, but I don't know if like your nociceptive sort of infrastructure works better when it's hot. Probably not. I know that there's a high threshold in general.
Yeah, insofar as it's like a temperature sensing nociceptor, the threshold for those is a lot higher. You know, like, you know, those are like the kind of things that would turn on when you burn yourself. And I don't think that I don't know, I'm not an expert here, but the internal muscle temperature, it feels like it would be unlikely to reach those types of temperatures, especially when you're actively exercising and you have, you know, high blood flow states to whisk that away, and then surface dissipation of heat and stuff like that too. But glad I live in a desert where apparently risk of DOMS and rhabdo is higher, but I'm getting by okay, it seems.
The increase in temperature just morcellates the muscle tissue, liquefies, and you're like, yeah, this is what's happening.
Yeah.
Finally, there's been a number of neural mechanisms, so from the brain and central nervous system, have been put forth to as causative of DOMS. One has to do with an evolutionary theory, where DOMS is a pain signal that we experience to protect us from severe disability. And the other has to do with physical compression of specialized nerve endings within the muscle spindle that take place during exercise. Now, with respect to evolution, it seems unlikely that DOMS would be terribly useful at protecting us from overexertion during activity, since it crops up days later after the activity, right? You're like, you would prefer, if it was an evolutionary mechanism to prevent you from overdoing it, that it would happen while you're doing the thing, so you stopped doing it. It also wouldn't seem to do an awesome job at preventing overexertion after a workout, as the peak of DOMS often correlates with the return of maximal force production during dynamic movements. So again, if it was preventing you from like doing further activity while you're sore and laid up, well, your performance should drop markedly. So that seems less likely. Again, it's difficult to separate the effects of fatigue from working out and DOMS itself. As far as the physical compression of specialized nerve endings in the muscle spindle, it's basically one research group that's been kind of working on this for a few years. I don't know how well that's been established, but it seems that at this point, most researchers agree that delayed onset muscle soreness cannot be explained by a single theory. And there's still a lot of uncertainty around, you know, what's actually causing it, which is not satisfying academically. But I do think that because there's additional nuance here, it just I'm accepting that sort of uncertainty. Austin, I don't know if I have a preferred like mechanism or ideology here. Do you have something that you favor?
I think what I would favor among these is a combination of the damage and inflammation theories. And I base that on the time course would fit that type of a mechanism. In other words, you sustain the quote unquote muscle damage, you know, as we see evidence of that, obviously, biochemically and histopathologically, when that's been examined, and they look at these various proteins, titin and costimers and all these other structural proteins that can get, you know, mechanistically, it makes sense that those would how those can get injured. And then not that injury itself is directly what's causing pain, but the subsequent immune response that comes in to kind of clean up the damage, repair, rebuild, restore. I can see that fitting the time course that I would expect over the course of several days. As far as why the pain peaks, at that point, that's a little bit more, you know, obviously puzzling, and that's where some of this, uncertainty, I think, comes from. But at the moment, that's probably the main mechanism that I favor. And it also seems to also fit with the purported interventions that we can do to reduce the risk of dealing with it, which we'll talk about next.
Yeah, that's a great segue. So like, you know, this is all like kind of academic stuff. We're just, what causes it? Push my glasses up my forehead. But, you know, are there unique risk factors for DOMS? And like, if so, what can we do about them? So a number of risk factors have been investigated and are widely like purported over the internet. And we're going to like squash a few of them, little Mythbusters sort of segment here. So one, age. People say, older individuals are more vulnerable to, delayed onset muscle soreness, feeling sore after a workout. But when it's actually been studied, they apply the same workout to both older individuals and younger individuals. There's really no increase in risk of DOMS severity or risk of DOMS period when comparing older untrained individuals to younger untrained individuals. And this has been studied actually a fair amount of time, so I feel pretty comfortable saying that. I think some people would come back at that and say, well, look, if you make an older person sore, that could really lay them up or really like compromise their quality of life because they don't have maybe this physiological reserve that younger individuals have. And I'm like, I can appreciate that risk, and I think it's coming from a good place. But my bigger concern is underdosing training to this vulnerable population who would benefit largely from maybe being more aggressive than less aggressive. I don't know. What do you think about that, Austin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's something that I am reluctant to make sweeping population-wide recommendations on, rather on prefer more individual kind of conversations about what's this person's habitual level of physical activity and what are we trying to achieve, and coming with a shared plan to like work towards that. You know, to whatever extent people anecdotally are more confident in there being a difference between younger and older populations, I think probably a fair amount of that can be attributed to like what's the baseline habitual level of physical activity. So, you know, younger people, you know, still more active in their life on average, that might, you know, render them a little bit more resilient to the effects of a workout, even if they are like not formally trained. Whereas the older person who may habitually be less active to a similar, you know, novel workout, they may experience a bit more soreness, but I attribute that similarly to like their baseline level of fitness and training than I do to the workout itself. If you have two people who've been on bed rest for a month and they have the same level of baseline fitness and you put them to the same workout, and the only difference is their age, I'm not super confident that there's going to be a drastic difference there. I'm just more about individualizing at that point.
And I think we're both risk averse just in general from like really programming stuff that's too much for people in general. But to me, age doesn't really come into the calculus. It's more so what have you been doing? Mm-hmm. And like, has that been well tolerated or not? If it's been well tolerated, then great. I feel like that's a good maybe starting dose. Mm-hmm. Maybe we could even go a little higher. Yeah. But yeah, age in by itself is doesn't really matter to me. Sex, same sort of thing. Seemingly no impact on delayed onset muscle soreness severity or risk of it, based on again a pretty substantial amount of data. Women, again, functionally their muscles are the same. Women do not have like inferior muscles to men. They work just the same, can be trained just the same relative improvement from training. So again, I'm more worried about underdosing here based on the perception that women are fragile or need a specialized care here, when in reality, the specialized sort of treatment they need should be more about exercise promotion and, you know, and legitimate strength conditioning versus like, well, you're a woman, so you need less volume or less load relatively. That's not the case. The only thing I saw that actually did have some decent data showing that it was a unique risk factor for delayed onset muscle soreness severity and risk was mood. We already discussed temperature a little bit, so like external environment, that can definitely contribute. But mood seemed to be the one that I maybe wouldn't have predicted from the get-go. So anxiety and or depression seemed to correlate with more severe DOMS. And this to me, if I had to explain it, and this is speculation to be clear, that maybe this is just a fatigue thing. Related to the total amount of stress the person is experiencing at a particular time, stress being this sort of nebulous term, meaning like not just the workout stuff, but environmental stuff, psychological related stress. If you want to, you know, lump anxiety and or depression as like psychological stress, and that just may be too much for an individual to tolerate. And so the fatigue level is potentially higher. I don't know if you like that explanation or if you just say, mood disorders may contribute to increased risk of DOMS.
Yeah, I think that I don't love that as a singular explanation, just because I don't love lumping all mood disorders in as like people with depression. It's like depression is so variable between people. And so even with anxiety, I don't like lumping anxiety in with depression. But you wonder, for example, like people with high anxiety, how much of it is an attentional focus issue? Like they experience the soreness that makes them, you know, uncomfortable, anxious. They can't take their attention off of it. And we know that attentional focus has a big role in like when people report pain intensity. If somebody's attention is fixated on an area, they're going to report higher pain intensity than somebody who's not fixated on it, which perhaps a certain subset of people with anxiety, they may have more of an attentional focus on areas of discomfort, or same with depression, whereas others might not. So another one of those like big bucket categories that should probably be broken out a little bit more. But I find it interesting, not shocking. We should address those things if they're relevant for a person.
Yeah, for sure. As far as things that have been researched as far as modifying delayed onset muscle soreness, is either reducing its severity or duration. So soft tissue work has been one that's like an umbrella term, including things like limb compression, stretching, massage, hot and cold therapy, and so on. They tend to have variable and in general, likely negligible changes with respect to DOMS rating. So a lot of this stuff is measured by the VAS, the visual analog scale of pain, right? And it's like, oh yeah, look, hot therapy, you know, heat therapy, post-workout, you know, reduced the pain scores by 2 millimeters. And you're like, don't care. It's like not clinically relevant at all. And I don't want to, you know, poo-poo on anybody's preferred sort of recovery kink, as it were. Like if it makes you feel good, go for it. I just think that in general, I would not expect these to be particularly useful overall. But if it makes you feel good, I feel good about it, as long as it doesn't compromise either your financial situation or your training situation, right? If you have the choice to like between should I stretch for 10 minutes or should I complete these extra 2 sets that I was supposed to do anyway, I'd pick the sets. But if you have enough time to do both, like great, go for it. Training seems to have the most effect on delayed onset muscle soreness that we have studied. So, and there's 2 separate mechanisms here. One is called exercise-induced analgesia, and the other one is the repeated bout effect. So EIA, or exercise-induced analgesia, is basically when you start exercising, maybe you have DOMS or some sort of soreness, and as you kind of warm up and you go through the movements, the pain tends to go down. Some of this is based on endorphins, some of it's based on, you know, movement in general and kind of like learning that you're actually fine, right? Sort of violating maybe some expectations there. So that seems to be pretty useful. And in fact, if you were like, oh, I'm really sore, what should I do right now to feel better? I mean, any sort of activity where you're moving the affected limb or limbs is likely going to be beneficial, even if it's a relatively low intensity. But then this brings up the question, well, like, should you train if you are sore? Like, if this is muscle damage, you guys said it's probably got some element of muscle damage. Should I train? Well, this has actually been studied where people have DOMS. They've trained real hard and they did it day in and day out after repeatedly without any sort of rest periods. Turns out training when you're sore not only doesn't reduce any sort of training-related adaptation with respect to strength, hypertrophy, or so on, it actually seems to maybe increase it if you do more training overall. There was one study where they had folks train arms for 21 days in a row doing a 1RM plus or minus some back off sets afterwards. And you're wondering like, well, what 21 days in a row, no days off? Like they had soreness for sure, but what happened? It's like, yeah, it turns out they all got stronger. And the people who did more training volume ended up getting more improvement in size as well. There was also a study comparing doing 3 times a week resistance training, the same program, either with rest days between the sessions or the sessions back to back to back. And again, both groups had DOMS. So you would suspect if you shouldn't train when you have DOMS, that the group who did rest had rest periods between their training days would have done better with respect to, you know, strength and hypertrophy. Turns out no differences after in the study period. So generally would recommend training if sore. So that's kind of the exercise-induced analgesia kind of discussion and rest day discussion. As far as repeated bout effect, it seems like the repeated bout effect was initially characterized by people doing one type of training and then weeks later coming back and doing that same task and they had less soreness. And they were like, huh, that's interesting, even though they didn't really do any exercise of that type in the interim. It also seems to transfer to similar exercises. Dr. Mike Zordos did something on bicep curls with dumbbells to preacher curls, and it seemed to actually like transfer over pretty well. As far as whether that transfers from like regular squat, like a back squat, to like a Zercher squat or like a pause squat, I would predict some, but again, if I have to be very stringent on our speculation time, that's admittedly speculative at this point. But I do think that's probably contributory, is like you're familiar with a task or similar task that probably reduces delayed onset muscle soreness risk overall. And also exercising while sore seems to reduce pain while you're doing it. The last thing here is protein. And I should say that assuming that somebody's getting about 1.4 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram of total body weight per day, there's little to no impact on delayed onset muscle soreness with protein in and above that level, which is kind of what we've been saying on all of these things. So people are hard up on like, eat more protein, you need protein, focus on protein. It's like, well, that's true if somebody's eating a low protein diet, you know, but most people aren't eating a low protein diet. So realistically, people need to have maybe one or two more servings of protein per day. That's the general population. But once you get to that 1.4 to 1.6 grams of protein per kilogram body weight per day, I have little concerns that protein is going to do like wonders for most folks. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's certainly not really anywhere on my areas of concern when working with somebody who's dealing with this. I kind of, if you're curious about, once I'm dealing with it, how can I manage it? Honestly, you can apply some of the same strategies we talk about with regular pain and, you know, injury type scenarios. So go to our resources on that, where we talk about managing, you know, load and exercise selection and stuff like that, moving around in different ways, getting below a symptom threshold, building back up from there, based on how you tolerate it. I would use a similar approach. And if you take away from that, you know, smarter strategies to dose your exercise and build in greater variation to your training, then you too can go on to live your life with not really any debilitating DOMS for the rest of your life. You might experience some mild bits here and there, but to the extent that it debilitates you, you will probably never experience that again if you are able to dose things appropriately and maintain sufficient variation.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. All right. So the take home here, delayed onset muscle soreness is pain, stiffness, and tenderness in the muscles that starts in the hours following a workout and peaks within about 24 to 72 hours. 48 hours is usually what most people will say. There is still a lot of uncertainty around the mechanism of what causes delayed onset muscle soreness, though it is pretty clear that loading the muscles eccentrically, so while they're stretched, is required. New exercises and or higher training loads likely increase the risk and severity of delayed onset muscle soreness, though age and sex don't seem to be related. It is highly likely that anyone who is serious about training will experience DOMS. If it's happening all the time, that suggests that the training load, so things like volume, proximity to failure, and or intensity are too great for the individual. On the other hand, if someone never experiences DOMS, it's likely that their training load isn't high enough. Perhaps paradoxically, continued training, even when sore, can reduce the severity of DOMS and the risk of future DOMS. Austin, anything you want to add for closing remarks?
I do not have any further comments.
All right. He's seated the rest of his time. Yeah. So that has been a wrap on episode 298 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Austin Baracki for joining us on the podcast. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance and health and fitness. From everyone here at Barbell Medicine, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. Hey guys, before we get into the podcast, I wanted to let you know that we're launching Barbell Medicine Plus so that we can expand on what we're doing with the podcast, the website, and beyond. Now, over the past 300 plus episodes, Dr. Baracki and I have tried our best to be one of your go-to resources for legit, evidence-based health and fitness information. But now, with your help, we want to do more. Barbell Medicine Plus subscribers will enjoy ad-free listening, and for nearly all of our episodes, receive access to an executive summary and an article, along with the transcript, a video version of the podcast, and exclusive access to a private forum to ask Dr. Baracki and I questions, which we'll answer on a monthly podcast that's released only to our subscribers. We'll be publishing other exclusive content for Plus members as well, and we've already uploaded a lot of resources for our subscribers and will continue to expand this offering. If you want to support what we're doing and become a Barbell Medicine Plus member, head over to barbellmedicine.com/plus and sign up to be a Barbell Medicine Plus member today. That's barbellmedicine.com/plus. Thank you in advance for your support. Let's get into the episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.